Hi, my name is John Kim. I'm a therapist who went through his own rebirth many years ago, and I've been documenting my journey ever since, sharing my life lessons and revelations. I believe in casual over clinical, with you instead of at you. I come unrehearsed on purpose because self-help doesn't have to be so complicated. So Sam Louis and I go way back. Here's what's interesting about Sam. So I grew up in an all-white neighborhood. Sam and I are roughly the same age. Sam grew up in a predominantly all black neighborhood. I grew up skateboarding. Sam grew up playing basketball. We both loved hip hop. And the way that I met Sam was I was at church and I didn't have many friends. And this guy, you know, we started talking. He's like, I got to introduce you to my friend Sam. He's also Asian. He's also going through a divorce. And he's also studying to be a therapist. And I remember that's why he brought me to your house. And that's how we met. And then from there, I remember the moment that Sam asked me for my phone number. And it was kind of a weird moment because it's kind of strange for guys to, because Sam and I are older and you know, we're kind of, we have our one foot into kind of like, you know, the old generation where asking a man for a phone number might be kind of weird. And I remember it was kind of forced. It was like, it's almost like you almost demanded it. It was almost like, you know, if you get nervous, instead of being polite asking, I think you threw me your phone and you were like, give me your phone number. And I was like, oh, shit. And from then on, we moved in together, became friends, and we went through divorce recovery together as we were working on ours toward licensure. And here's what's interesting, and you could see this literally on YouTube. Now, if you look at Sam, he became the shirt and tie guy, right? The classic therapist.
I only dressed up for you, man.
No, come on. Yeah, you
I
got
don't normally
on.
Wear such a nice shirt.
No, oh, come on, 100%. You got slacks on, and
jeans,
but he's got
nice
an office
because of you.
He's got an office. He's got a full practice. And he's in Washington, you know, he's the, I mean, you know, you're the classic therapist, right? Look at your book displayed, you know, just perfectly. And then here's me. And also look at the hair. Sam has no hair. I've got this long hair, curly. And I'm in my garage, you know, playing with my phone and just, you know, I'm like no practice, playing with my quote unquote Legos.
Yin yang, baby. Yin
yes.
yang.
So I'm just saying it's just really interesting how we have so much in common, but also as therapists we took very different roads and here we are, and there's a visual, you know, the Sam with his cactus and me with my, you know, little book posters.
Yin
so
and
Sam,
yang.
Let's talk about shame. One of the things that Sam's passionate about in his brand new book, Passport to Shame. Congratulations, by the way.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. Oh, you got it. They finally sent it to you.
Yeah, they just sent it to me right before this. And you know what I found interesting? Just in the beginning, it talks about how there are more than 300 words in Chinese for shame.
Yeah.
Let's start with that. So Sam's Chinese American. I'm Korean American. Tell me about shame and you growing up with shame.
I think one of the biggest areas of shame was just keep in mind you were born in the U.S. I was born overseas.
No, that's not true. I was born in Korea.
Oh, no.
I came here when I was three.
Oh, okay. You came here when? Do you even remember being an immigrant?
I remember because we landed in Columbus, Georgia. You know, 76, and I remember the feeling because I was like my daughter's age. I remember the feeling of going into restaurants and not being wanted. I remember the feeling of that. So I don't remember what was said, but I know there was a lot of racism. And I remember us leaving restaurants and being confused and kind of feeling this like, you know, the of not being wanted. That's the feeling I felt. When did you come to America?
I think it was closer to four because I was slapped into kindergarten shortly thereafter. But I do remember being really young on a bus. Everybody's black with my grandmother, and like not necessarily feeling unwanted per se, but wasn't sure where I fit right? Mm. I'm on a bus. Everybody's black except right. my grandma and me. And then keep in mind, grandma's speaking to me in Chinese.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I'm trying to speak back to her in English, knowing she's not going to understand me because I just wanted to make sure everybody on the bus would treat me as the an same. American. I don't know how they viewed me, but I did not want to be viewed as a foreigner.
So yes, I agree. My bus was white, and my grandma was also with me. Did your grandma come because your parents were working, so they needed your grandma to kind of raise you, take care of you? Is that why your grandma was here?
Well, my dad was able to get sponsored by a restaurant just south of Seattle to be their head cook. Mm. I know that sounds like a glamorous position, but it really isn't.
Well, you said cook, not chef. It's not a head chef, head cook.
Head cook, head chef. It didn't matter to me because at the end of the day, he's slaving away in these kitchens. And my mom's working at a different Chinese restaurant as a waitress. But there's no such thing as a paid vacation.
Right.
There's no health insurance. So they're always working, you know, and they're not making a lot of money working at these, restaurants.
Wait, this is the 80s, right?
They moved here mid 70s.
Same story. My parents, my dad was not a cook. He was pulling telephone cable working for GTE. And my mom
was making some money.
No, he wasn't.
Government employee, manual labor.
And
my mom was making
egg rolls and shit, selling in a little hamburger stand. But they were gone constantly. And so it was like my grandma who was home. And I remember I have this memory of when I was like 10, my grandma was washing me and my brother in the bathtub. And, you know, Koreans, when it comes to scrubbing, it's just no joke. And she would scrub me so hard with it's like when you go to, women who go to Korean spas, they're like, dude, these Korean grandmas are fucking aggro. Like, they'll scrub you. Like, yeah. And so my grandma used to scrub me with this thing. It was like a fucking stone. And one day she had both of us in there. We were way too old to be, you know, in the bathtub with our grandma. And she would be scrubbing us. And you know, we're screaming and stuff. And it was right next to the front door. And our friends heard us. And they're like, oh, my God, you guys, our white friends, heard us. And they're like, you, and then they start making fun of us for, at 10 years old, being in the bathtub with your grandma. Like, what's wrong with you guys?
Mm.
So
what about language? Any, making fun of the Korean language?
Oh, all the time.
When they heard it?
Yes. Oh. The smell of kimchi in our house. They sell kimchi at Trader Joe's now. And I don't know how I feel about that because it's become so, you know what I'm saying? Like Korean barbecue. When you go to Korean barbecue, it's mostly
Korean
white people.
Korean food is like. Korean barbecue is now in vogue.
Dude, when I was growing up, I had crushes on little white girls who kind of liked me, and then they would come into my house and be like, hell no, what's that smell? And then they would never come over again. And speaking of shame, so I, like you, had a lot of shame growing up in the 80s in a very white world being this little Korean kid, right? So tell me about your shame. Keep going.
I wanted to, you know, because we're talking about the differences and similarities, can I read a quick paragraph from my book in the beginning?
Yes, of course. Of course.
This is
not a poem.
Yeah, right.
This is not a poem,
no,
Sam.
No, this is not the poem.
Okay, because Sam Sam does poetry. His poems rhyme. They're a little, you know, they're a little different.
Some of them don't rhyme.
Oh, I didn't
know
that.
As I got better at the poetry, I said I can't make these rhyme. I'm trying to force it.
Yeah. When the poems don't rhyme, they're actually better. I just didn't want to say anything.
Now it's considered art.
yeah. Now it's abstract.
Okay,
art.
So here's this first paragraph. I hate myself. This was one of my earliest thoughts as a Chinese boy in the United States. I wasn't white like those I saw on television, and I wasn't black like those in my neighborhood. I was an Asian immigrant. Mm. I was an outsider, a foreigner, the other. It was 1976, and I was 4 years old. I hated looking different, speaking differently, and having different customs and traditions from mainstream America. I say mainstream America, but I should also include Black America, which also part of the environment I grew up in.
Yeah. So, I can relate to you on so many levels. And so with that, how does, you know, a 10-year-old, a Chinese boy, how does he process this? How did you internalize this, not fitting in and trying to be American and all of that?
So it's, you know, how we always tell kids and even ourselves as adults, be proud of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Be proud of yourself. Be proud of where you came from.
Right.
And that took a lot of time until probably middle school. That too. But like middle school, I started having a little bit of ethnic pride because there is this thing called ethnic self-hatred. Right.
Sure.
As you said, or as you heard earlier, I'm hating the fact that I'm Chinese. Yep. I want to scrub. I look in the mirror. I want to scrub. Like I was trying to, you know, at one point I said, like, can this yellow skin get actually scrubbed off? No, it can't. And it wasn't until I found my basketball, there was an Asian basketball association in my neighborhood, and I joined it. And now I'm surrounded by not only other peers my age, but also the coaches. They were a generation just ahead of me, but they were what I aspired to. They went to college.
Right.
They had quote, regular jobs, professional jobs, as opposed to immigrant jobs. Because prior to meeting them, everybody was what I knew from my parents and my parent circle. Okay, everybody is working at a kitchen, a Chinese restaurant, maybe one person works for the post office, but you know, very blue collar jobs, and you didn't see beyond what you knew.
Right.
So once I was immersed in this all Asian basketball program, boys, girls of various ages, from first graders all the way to high school, and I'm kind of right in the middle, starting right around fifth or sixth grade, I'm like, wow, I can actually feel like, at least in this circle, I'm not as ashamed of who I am because, hey, we're all the same now.
Wait, was it because of your ability to play basketball?
No, because we're all Asian. We're all Asian.
Oh,
you guys are Asian basketball league.
Oh,
and you're playing
Asian,
against.
Right.
Our coaches are all Asian. All the volunteers are Asian. So then when you're meeting all the parents, some of the parents are more Americanized. So they're talking to me in English, which is, whoa, what's going on? Because remember, all the adults I knew can only speak Chinese.
Right.
So I have people speaking to me in English and calling me by my name, like, wow, this is just awkward. Hi, Mr. Wong. You know, hi, Mrs. Wong, Mr. and Mrs. Chin. Like, you get to know them on a relational level, which was a bit, that was the other piece that was missing, is because my parents were working and there's a language barrier. The relationship was just wasn't there.
Yeah. So, do you think, because the other thing that you and I have, and I think, I don't know if you believe in addiction being, you know, in our blood or not, is kind of like the addictive gene, you know? And I know with you, and also for me, when I was around 12, I was exposed to a lot of images way too early. And I remember, you know, asking my friend to steal his brother's Playboys and penthouses and just being obsessed with women and nudity. And I was, you know, I was just a little kid. And I think it was my way of numbing. I think it was my way of, you know, partly I wasn't supervised. So, you know, I was out till 2 a.m. I was doing all sorts of shit with the neighborhood kids. But I wonder if that, because that was the first introduction to anything pornographic. It was the 80s, around 12, right? And you were also, I mean, in your book, you were also exposed to that, that, right?
Scrambled TV. But I wanted to get to your first point before I forgot. Three generations of addictions, at least three generations. My
gambling, lots of gambling, it says in your book.
Was always gambling.
Yeah.
Aunts and uncles gambling. Some ended up in divorce.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, my brothers have their own issues of whether it's spending or you know, sexual things, just like myself. So I do mm-hmm. think they're not that it was like there's a gene per se, but the environment was not one of emotional intimacy.
Right.
And keep in mind, my grandparents were arranged marriage. So that's probably why Grandpa was always, the only image I have of him is Grandpa standing at the bus stop, ready to take the bus to the horse racetrack in Seattle.
Mm. Oh, to gamble?
Yeah, to gamble. Yeah. I mean, this was a big deal, horse racing. And people would say, well, horse racing, this is a popular sport in Chinese culture or back in Hong Kong where my parents grew up. It's really not that big of a deal, but it's just another way to kind of disconnect.
Yeah.
So I do believe that level of disconnection kind of passed down through the generations to me. And like yourself, I was telling my therapist the other day, and it finally hit me. I don't know why. I don't even know if it hit me when I brought it up in the book. But I mentioned to my therapist earlier last week, gosh, there are so many hours, partly because we're dads now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's hard for us to fathom our kids being unsupervised. Right. Mm, this whole concept of latchkey kids that the 80s, primarily 80s grew up in, you know, it was kind of a perfect storm. You got women going off to work. My mom was now going out in the workforce. There weren't a lot of daycare centers. If people could, even if they could afford it, right, they didn't have a lot of after school programs and things like that.
Right.
So kids were just left unsupervised.
Yeah, and crazy. We just came home when it got dark outside, and we were, you know, drinking out of hoses and just fucking, wild, man, animals.
The positives is we learned to be self-sustaining, right? Like, I could just use my imagination. I don't need a lot of money to have fun, right?
Right.
Right. We could just figure things out. We could go out with a stick and whack through some sticker bushes, create a trail, and feel like we're adventurers.
Sure. Yeah, just get on our bikes and just go out, do shit. You know, I remember digging tracks and, you know, playing little race cars and building Legos. And so you're right, imagination, creativity, not by choice, but because we didn't have anything else then.
Yeah, and just the sense of autonomy, right? If you wanted to do something, you had to do it. There's no parent guiding you along, encouraging you along. Yeah. I remember I was 12. And I was like, gosh, we don't have a lot of money, but I want things. How do I get things? And I remember at the back of this comic book, you could sign up. And if you sold things, like if you sold posters or whatever you sold, you earned credit so that you could get a toy or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember 12 years old, knocking on doors, trying to sell these subscriptions to things with no supervision. Like, how do you even do this, right? Like, you're just out there doing it. But so those are the positive things. I think the more impactful things was no adult supervision.
Yeah.
I'm also in a bit of a crime-ridden neighborhood, so there are a lot of emotions I had to stuff.
Like what? Fear and being afraid?
I was the oldest of three, so I had to kind of tend to my two younger brothers. So imagine parents are just gone working at night. And that's when I started biting my nails, if we call something addictive or compulsive. I started just gnawing on my nails.
Wow.
I didn't realize this till more recently at 8 years old. Just gnawing on my nails. And my therapist was like, well, what's that all about? And what do you imagine? It's like, oh, I just remember being about 8 to 10 years old, taking care of my parents, and it's very pitch black outside, worried about crime, getting robbed or whatever. And I'm just biting my nails to lower the fear and anxiety.
Yeah. Coping. So there's that's so how you're much, coping.
Yeah. So this was maybe my first one. And obviously we're at home, but we also got TV. So we're every TV show that you can imagine, we're watching. To start off the numbing effect.
Yes, yes. Also, the pantry. Every sugar cereal you could imagine. Sam and I have a joke because the other thing we have in common is we're going through a divorce at the same time. I think you got divorced first, and we were coming home from Big Bear with a friend, female, and it was one of the times I think I've laughed the hardest in my life, where I my stomach was hurting. We used to ask our wives for permission to buy sugar cereal, and then, and I thought I was the only one. He's like, no, me too. And it was just like a silly moment, but I remember I was laughing so. Sam was driving, he almost crashed, and I remember the woman in the back, she was like, what the fuck did I get myself into? Who are these people? Who are these clowns? And I was in the front seat riding shotgun. I was laughing so hard I had to get out of my seat and kneel forward. So I'm kneeling forward, bent over in pain, laughing. Sam is laughing so hard that the car is swerving. And then our
you
poor
told me
friend.
To pay attention to the drive.
Yeah, we're coming down the hill, coming down the mountain, and our poor friend in the back was just like, "What the fuck is going on?" She did no laughing. She didn't understand our jokes. But I'm saying this because it reminds me of. the sugar cereal, and you know, growing up in the 80s,
freedom.
Yes,
unbridled
junk
freedom,
food, access to anything,
anything you wanted. So then my one of our friends had scrambled TV. I don't know if your listeners know what that is, but scrambled TV is
cable
access to unpaid subscriptions.
Yes,
but
when cable first came out,
in the sense that the image is blurred out. You can't really see it, or you see a little bit of it, but you can still hear it. So I remember we would come across something that was Playboy or erotic or, you know, with disco themes. And man, 10, 11, 12, I don't know. But it was like, whoa, what is that? Everything is like, you know, and obviously puberty is hitting. So it felt like this lock and the key where I was just entranced. If I thought I was entranced with regular TV or video games and, you know, Legos or Star Wars, now with puberty, this was like, oh man, this was it.
Were you able to see enough where you're like, oh, that's a boob, or oh, that's, or was it so scrambled that it was more of the noises, the sex noises that fascinated you?
In the 70s or 80s, porn music.
Yeah, but people were making sex noises. It wasn't
the combination.
That wasn't
of,
the music.
Was, you know, the disco. It was a combination of everything. It was the trifecta. Because prior to that, I didn't have video. The only thing I had, I remember our parents would get like JCPenney's, whatever those department store catalogs. And you might be able to come across like the lingerie section. But that was it, right? You know, it's not really, there's a lot of mental energy to have to go into that fantasy world, whereas now you actually see it, or kind of see it, and you hear it. And that was like the perfect storm to getting hooked.
I wonder if because it was scrambled, and because you know you're watching something you shouldn't be watching, that was part of the high. Do you know what I'm saying? You're doing something bad. Part of the dopamine, part of the high was to, because like for me, the same thing, to be in my dad's room and put on TV or select TV, and it was playing the Playboy channel while they were at work, and doing something I wasn't supposed to be doing was, you know, that element of danger is partly what drew me to it.
Yeah, there was the thrill knowing that we shouldn't be watching this.
Yeah,
we were. Our brains are getting a little bit of more than a little bit. It's getting a high because there's something that we knew developmentally. It's not sinking right at the, let's say,
you don't even know what you're
age.
Watching, right? But also, you're right. Puberty. So we're very curious. You know, this is when you are putting your penis in the, you know, in anything, vacuums, fucking, you know, plums, anything to, you know, this is when people are putting, you know, kids are putting peanut butter on their balls to get their dogs to, like, anything to feel something, because they're so curious about sex, but they're not ready for sex. So this is the wonder years, you know?
Oh,
and, yeah. And so you and I both kind of numbing, escaping, coping, because we were latchkey kids in the 80s.
And, you know, keep in mind, not just numbing because our parents are not around, that is one element. And for me, obviously, the fear of, you know, crime and what have you. But there's also what's next? Like, our parents are working. There's no talk about life. Like, these fears are growing with each, what's the right word? Each transition time. I remember feeling very anxious from elementary school to middle school. Once again, I'm the oldest in the family. Nobody's ever gone to school in the U.S. I'm going to be the first to go graduate from college and so on and so forth. And now I got like six different classes. I got locker combination, six different teachers, middle school. Okay, now I got high school. Now I have college. I have a future. All I hear from my parents are, oh, hey, just get good grades.
Yeah, yeah.
What's the other lecturing thing that they would say? Oh, don't hang around bad people. Yeah, that's it. That's my blueprint for life. Just get good grades. Don't hang out with bad people.
Sad.
And I don't think we fit into the Asian stereotype. I wasn't really that good of a student, at least not when it came to traditional.
That's another place where we overlap. We're both idiots. We're both academically not smart.
We're not STEM oriented. The science, technology, engineering, math. We're not that. So it's like, oh my gosh, I see my friends doing well, and I'm like, and now I'm seeing my grades starting to plummet in these math and sciences, and I'm not even interested in it either. Now,
yeah, me too.
And then my
parents are
telling me like, hey, we have friends whose sons and daughters are engineers, they're doctors,
Harvard,
they're business
kind of
people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they're like, what about you, Sam? So now they're starting to say something about my future. And I'm like, that doesn't sound like me. Mom, dad, I don't know how to voice that. I now have some deep insecurities about who I am as a person, as a, you know, don't forget the masculinity side, as a man, but who am I to grow into? All these fears and insecurities.
Yeah.
And, you know, pornography at the time was a great way to continue to numb it out. Pornography, I say pornography, but there's a lot of things. I'm biting my nails, listening to hours on music.
Mm-hmm.
At one time, I would just play basketball by myself. Countless hours playing basketball by myself in the rain in Seattle, because it was just a way to just escape. There's just so much. I don't know if I've used the word fear and insecurity enough, but there's a lot of that.
And you know, this didn't stop because, then you did grow up, right? And then you started, like me, running toward the picket fence, and you got married, and I was going to say weatherman. You weren't a weatherman, but you were a news anchor, and you had a very respectable job. A reporter. Weren't you also nominated for an Emmy? Or you got started getting awards, and you were living a life that was very, like, Emmys. On paper, very, very successful.
But even before that, I remember when I first started off as a cub reporter, I was very scared because I was like, okay, I'm making no money here in the middle of nowhere, which was Montana, but I was working as a reporter and I just felt this crushing weight. And I told myself, it was more passive suicidal thoughts. I'd rather be dead than return home to Seattle, not having, quote, succeeded in this career in television journalism. So that was actually when it finally started taking off. Cause I don't remember, like, in college, you know, I was just like too busy once again, maybe numbing out with partying and what have you, but it wasn't until my first job in Montana. I'm lonely. I'm by myself. I got these fears of performing cause it's my first journalism job. Am I even going to make it in this career? That was the very first time, I think it was 20, 21 or 22, whatever. Finally entered my very first, quote, adult bookstore and just loaded up on a bunch of magazines. It was such a great way of just numbing out and not having to worry about the day-to-day grind and how awful. Keep in mind, I was, you know, when you first start off at any career, but especially one as public as television news reporting, if you go to a smaller city, it's just awful. I mean, I was awful. I'll just use eye language. I could never see myself going from here. Look how awful I am on TV, the way I look, the way I sound.
No.
Just sounds like just a B-rate college newscast, and envisioning myself in a bigger city.
So you weren't happy and you were very self, criticizing and judgmental on yourself. And then came divorce. And, you know, of course, with divorce is more shame, more stigma, more labels.
Oh, yeah. This was in the early 2001 or whatever that time frame was. So I was, amongst all my Asian peers growing up, I only knew one other Asian person that got divorced.
Mm. What was it like for you to get divorced? And it wasn't, wasn't your idea, right? Did your ex-wife bounced, or whose idea was it to divorce?
Oh, so once again, it just escalated as my, as the job requirements got more intense, right? Mm-hmm. I'm working in Los Angeles, the pressure, it doesn't get easy when you get to a bigger city, right? More pressure to perform, didn't want to screw up. And so I think I remember every night just going home, drowning myself out in more pornography. And one night she just woke up, saw me doing it, screamed, and we separated, did a little bit of couples counseling. But at the end of the day, that was too overwhelming for her. And it was excruciating because I thought we were just going to live, die, whatever. I had envisioned a life with her, not just her, but also her family, because they were Americanized. Keep in mind, she was a Korean American whose family was more Americanized. Her parents were educated out here, so I could talk to them. Does that make sense? I actually had a relationship with
them.
Right.
It wasn't superficial. It was like real relationships, blended family.
And it feels shameful. I don't know if shameful to say, but kind of embarrassing to say. But I felt like I was much closer to my then mother-in-law than to my own mom.
Yeah, of course. I get
partly
that.
Because of the ability to talk in English.
Yeah.
But also because she was educated here. She went to grad school in the US. She understood that it made sense that I had to move around the country to do what I had to do back then. Whereas my mom would say, "Why don't you just work at this TV station in Seattle?"
Right. Right.
Right out of college. So yeah, that was really painful.
That's about when I met you, right? Divorce. Maybe a year or two after your divorce is when I met you.
Yeah. Was I in grad school yet, or just thinking about it?
I think you were in grad school. Yeah, because you were already. I think you're even past that because you were getting your hours, or you're just finishing grad school, your hours. And we kind of met each other at our lowest points of our lives.
I may have been low. It may have been you've gotten even lower right around that. I can't remember right around that time because I thought the pornography was the low point, or the divorce was the low point. Mm-hmm. But there are times of really struggle post-divorce where I didn't know what was to become of me. Maybe I was still going to therapy or training to be a therapist, but relationally, the level of rejection was so high. I remember whenever there are a few times where I was able to go overseas, what have you, and I would hire escorts, prostitutes, what have you. Mm-hmm. And that felt very low because
the shame behind
who
that
knows and... if these women, I think some of these women may have been sex trafficked as well.
Right.
Before sex trafficking was even really known. And so that was very, I think in hindsight, very crushing to know I'm both a perpetrator, right? Perpetrator to a certain degree.
Because you're participating, you mean?
Yeah, I'm participating in these acts. At the time, I thought it was everything's consensual. I pay money, but you know, I was very naive. But yeah, once I got there, it felt very low, quote, low.
Yeah. So let me ask you this. Most of your life, you know, I mean, this book is called Passport to Shame. So just living with shame since, you know, being a little Chinese boy, and, you know, thank you for being so honest and sharing your story. I can relate to, I mean, you know, you're almost like a doppelganger, not because you look like me, but because we have such similar stories. How did you now, because I want to start turning this around. How did you start dissolving, scraping shame? How did you start working on this so it doesn't become the monster that follows you around, you know?
It's still a work in progress. I think it happened in stages. Part of it was getting help. Finally, as an Asian ethnic person, to say, I need help.
Yeah.
That's a huge breakthrough. To actually walk through the doors of a therapist and talk to a therapist was, I think, very instrumental. I think through the years, I don't know if these concepts seems too fluffy, but learning to love myself regardless, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
Warts and all. And this is it. I just saw, no pun intended, I saw that movie, Dumb Money, the other day, you know, about the whole GameStop stock market
thing. No, I haven't seen it, but okay.
But anyways, there's a line where he tells the main character, his brother, dude, you just got to go run with your dick out.
Uh-huh.
Meaning forget, stop hiding from the media. Just be out there. And I was like, you know what? No pun
intended.
That's
how I've been living my life for the last 15 years. Or just
I'm just
going to
run
dick
with
out.
My dick out. Yeah, I'm going to run with my dick out. I'm just going to own it. So maybe this is a little bit of you and me, like just having the courage to be unabashed. Because as you know, I'm more traditional. I'm not really one mm-hmm. to self-disclose a lot.
Sure. Yeah.
And I just told my therapist the other week, I'm wrestling with a little bit, but I'm starting to say, forget it. I'm just going to go out, balls out, and just, who cares if people know my story? But the people who know my story are are going to need the story. And if I don't share the story, how are they ever possibly going to get the help that they possibly need?
And also, you know, shame lives in secrecy, and so I can imagine. I mean, I write books. You writing this book, sharing your story in a way must have been very therapeutic. Must have been very kind of letting things go. And also, you know, the idea of our stories helping other people then makes our story bigger than us. You know, there's almost a spiritual part to this too.
There was a lot of there were some tears shed in writing some parts of this book.
Yeah.
And this was not the book I envisioned when I first started. The publisher, I gave them the draft. They liked it. But immediately they wanted to shift it. So 80% of it was more like just cerebral stuff, like
Asian,
very generic. Right. And then the 20%, if that was my story, they say, we want to flip this. We want to make this more 80 to 90% your story, a little bit about generic Asian dynamics. I'm like, what? I didn't like that at all.
Well, because then you had to share. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's even promoting this book is difficult, but you know, I talked a little bit about how I do some poetry. This might answer the question of how did I work through the shame? This one's titled Redefining My Shame.
Shit. Warning. Here comes one of Sam's poems about to drop.
Spoken, not broken, healing through poetry.
Here we go.
Redefining
let's hear it.
My
let's
shame.
Hear it. Okay, let's hear it.
I used to hate my shame, run away from it, hide from it, ignore it, deny it, pretend it's not there. Now, like a parent to a child, I embrace it. No more shame in naming it, sharing it, using it to my advantage, helping others heal. Where I once whimpered, I now boldly proclaim it. Where I once drowned in it, I've now harnessed it. Like a mule, use it as a tool, redefined it. No longer a soul crusher, use my shame, a light for others to escape self-blame. So just finding a way to reframe, redefine it, I think that's been another aspect of the healing.
Absolutely. I mean, starting with owning it, not letting it have power over you by keeping it secret. So, you know, you writing a book about it, you being on my podcast, you talking about your story, in a way that is owning it, embracing it. And then there's a tipping point when you start to share it, where it comes bigger than you. I think that's huge with shame. Do you struggle today with shame? What is your relationship with shame, and how is it impacting you today as, you know, a family? Now you're a husband, you're a father, you know, you have a full practice, you've got tons of clients. You don't feel shame much anymore? Where are you today with shame?
No, I think the shame is still there in that I wish it was a different sort of a quote addiction, right? I wish it was alcoholism. you know.
Why? Because you can't like put your finger on it, or you can't see it. You can't like count the
bottles.
Well,
if you're saying I've recovered. I'm a recovering alcoholic. There's less shame because it's just the sexual piece. It's just
sex. Yeah.
Yeah, our sexual piece. It's such a what's the right word? Such a vulnerable part of who we
are.
Yeah,
of course,
right?
Of course. Yeah.
And to say that, like, yeah, starting as young as this, I struggled. It's not a very masculine part of it. It's not very masculine. It feels more masculine to say I've been hooked on drugs or alcohol. But to say I struggled with sexual imagery and masturbation and pornography,
up to
prostitutes and escorts, it just feels very
dirty gross. Yeah, yeah.
The morality piece gets in there too, and obviously morality was a part of the shame for the early alcoholics, right? They were viewed as people who had moral issues, you know, something.
But
wrong
don't
with
you
morally.
Think today, especially because I had a similar experience with my ex-wife, where got a lot of judgment and labels slapped on me because I had a video on my computer, and it was one video. But back then, I think the judgment and the shame was much. It had a more of a grip than I think today, where. Especially with just kind of fluidity, openness, you know, sexuality and what we're into, whether it's kink or whatever, it's not so confined. There, you know, people aren't judging as much anymore. Do you know what I'm saying? So like
mainstream
sex
America,
addiction. Well, yeah, maybe because we live in big
we're
cities.
We're still in our Asian ethnic, in my head, I'm still in the Asian ethnic culture and community, and that's still I mean, I think I could speak to any white audience, it doesn't matter. But you know, once we get to a more ethnic audience, that level of shame does creep up a little bit.
Yeah, more. Yeah, I get that. I understand that.
Yeah.
Hey, I know you have a ton of clients, and I know we're pretty much out of time. I just want to say that you know, I'm really proud of you because, you know, we fuck around a lot. We joke a lot. We make fun of each other.
Yeah.
We're very competitive, whatever. But all jokes aside, Sam, I'm really proud of you for writing this book, man. And I'm really proud of where you're at in your life. You know, I can't say a lot about the three wheel motorcycle you bought, the Harley with three wheels. Yeah, I'm gonna leave that no comment. But
it looks just like yours, but has a third wheel.
Okay, so we're gonna. I don't even know if it's a motorcycle or a car because it has three wheels. But other than that, Sam, you're doing a lot of important work, and I'm really proud of you, man. Because I was with you when we had nothing, man. All we had was frozen yogurt in our hands. We had, you know, we're trying to pick up girls, and then we discovered CrossFit, and God, we're just complaining about our life and job, and we're just like drifting in Los Angeles with no broke and just aimless.
We didn't have much materially, but remember, we didn't even have a TV. We consciously said no TV because we wanted to be able to grow, go to coffee shops, read, learn. But I do remember one thing you said that still resonates today. Like, you know, we don't have much, right? Materially, we lost everything, relationally, divorce, and so on, and so forth. But you know what we do have is we are now changed. This is a before.
I said that?
Yeah, you said something
wow.
We are now forever changed because of this experience.
Mm.
And I'm not saying people have to go through a divorce to go through this experience,
but
people are going through other crises or other, what's the right word? Life altering experiences that there's going to be that before and after. So I realized, like, man, even though we don't have much, we are never back to who we used to be.
Right,
and that's
right.
A good thing is what you mentioned.
Of course.
Like,
it's valuable. Yeah. I don't remember saying that.
Right.
And you know, thank God I didn't say we don't have much, but all we have is each other. Thank God I didn't say that. I agree that you know, the refusal to be who you used to be has value and worth. And so we were both on a path of you know, in our hero's journey and just going through it, man. And I don't know if I could have done it without you, Sam. I mean, you were such a pivotal part of that because you brought humor, you brought lightness, You brought, you know, because we were we were lonely too. You know, we were in our heartbreak motel in K-Town. And in a way, all we kind of had was each other. And so all those lonely nights of just kind of hanging out, talking, you know, doing whatever, I think got us through, you know, all those.
It was a great synergy. Yeah, it was a great synergy to be able to have your creative juices just emanating.
Well, thank you.
And I think I picked up on, you know, when you look at the yin and yang, there's still a little bit of the other color on the
book. Oh, sure.
The black side has a little bit of the white. Right. The white has a little bit of black.
Right.
So you're oozing creativity and extroversion and self, what do you call it? Self-disclosure. So there's a little bit of that in what I try to do that's been inspired by you. So I really appreciate, you know, your ability to really, like when I first met you and I saw some of those videos, my classmates in marriage and family therapy, like, please tell me he's not a therapist. I said, why? He really is.
The one with me, the Valentine's Day where I'm shooting the target. Oh God, that was so inappropriate. I would have gotten canceled.
But it was just, it just speaks to your ability to just be so out there, right?
Dude, like, I was running with my dick out. I was running with my dick out because I had nothing else, man, except my blog and my stories.
I think that's the best way to end it. For the two of us, we'll continue running with our dicks out.
That's what this episode's going to be called, Running with Our Dicks Out with
running
John
with
and
our
Sam.
Dicks out. Yeah, I like that. I like that.
All right, let's do it. Well, hey, congrats on the book. Hey, where can we pick up
Appreciate this book?
Twide? Amazon?
My publisher said it's supposed to be at regular bookstores like Barnes & Noble, but obviously it's on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all the online retailers. Yeah.
It's an important book. Check it out. Passport to Shame. It's not only Sam's story, but he's also a licensed therapist. So he's very smart and has lots of great things to say. And shame is universal. It doesn't matter what color your skin is. So yeah, check that out. And Sam, thank you for being on my podcast. Great seeing your face.
Thanks, John. And I appreciate everything that you've been doing.
Thank you, man. I appreciate it. All right, Sam, love you. Be well, man. Uh-huh. Bye.
Yep, likewise.